What specific techniques have been employed by the FBI and its predecessors to undermine groups, from labor organizers in the late 19th century to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement in the late 1960s? What were the circumstances that led to the standoff between federal agents and AIM at Wounded Knee more than 40 years ago? Why was Leonard Peltier implicated in the deaths of the two FBI agents, and why does he remain in custody? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we complete our trilogy of stories focusing on American political prisoners by speaking with well-known academic, author, and American Indian Movement member Ward Churchill. On this week's program, COINTELPRO, Leonard Peltier, and the Limits of Resistance, Conversation with Ward Churchill. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 5th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory and on the homeland of the Métis people. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The World Health Organization declared the Zika virus a global health emergency on Monday, February 1st, without providing much detail on the disease. The sexually transmitted virus has been around for 69 years and is marketed by two companies, LGC Standards, headquartered in the UK, and ATCC, headquartered in the US. And who owns the patent on the virus? The Rockefeller Foundation. Why has the issue of patent ownership of the Zika virus not been the object of media coverage? That comes from the article, Who Owns the Zika Virus? By Guillaume Cress, posted February 3rd. The U.S. falsely blamed Iraq for playing a role in the 9/11 attacks, as shown by a memo from the Defense Secretary, as one of the main justifications for launching the Iraq War. Top U.S. government officials now admit that the Iraq War was really launched for oil, not 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. Despite previous lone wolf claims, many U.S. government officials now say that 9/11 was state-sponsored terror, but Iraq was not the state which backed the hijackers. Many U.S. officials have alleged that 9/11 was a false flag operation by rogue elements of the U.S. government, but such a claim is beyond the scope of this discussion. The key point is that the U.S. falsely blamed it on Iraq when it knew Iraq had nothing to do with it. That comes from the article, 58 Admitted False Flag Attacks, by Washington's blog, posted February 3rd. PricewaterhouseCoopers recently published the results of a survey that collected the opinions of 1,409 CEOs of 83 countries on the economic panorama. 66% of those interviewed considered that their corporate organizations face greater threats today than 3 years ago, and only 27% think that global growth will improve. The uncertainty is such that during the Davos summit, there was no consensus among business giants as to when the next crisis will hit. With this, the Western press did not hesitate to point out that the deceleration of China is the principal cause of the turbulence in the world economy. In fact, George Soros, who hit the pound sterling in the 1990s, maintained in Davos that a violent landing of the Chinese economy is inevitable, without doubt, an exaggerated affirmation. In my judgment, there is a propaganda campaign against Beijing that attempts to hide the serious economic and social contradictions that persist in the industrialized countries, the United States, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Japan, etc. That comes from the article, Where Will the Next Global Economic Crisis Explode? Colossal Stock Market Losses in 2016, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted February 3rd, originally appearing in Spanish on Russia Today. So implementing a ceasefire is the UN's top priority, as it is Washington's. But why would Putin agree to a ceasefire now, just when the Russian-led coalition is making great strides on the battlefield, the war's momentum has shifted in his favor, and the jihadist militias appear to be on the ropes? He probably won't agree to a ceasefire, nor will he agree to have Assad be removed by force of arms, but he might be willing to ease up on his current military offensive and even allow the US to retain captured territory in eastern Syria that could be used for future pipeline corridors, if he thought that Russia would benefit from the deal. What if the Saudis, acting on behalf of their friends in Washington, offered to cut back production so prices began to rise and Russia's economy started to rebound? That comes from the article, Oil Price Treachery. Are the Saudis blackmailing Putin for concessions on Syria? By Mike Whitney, posted February 3rd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. On November 16th, 2015, F. William Engdahl headlined, Do We Really Want a New World War with Russia? And he itemized the ways in which Russia's military performance in both Ukraine and Syria has shocked the U.S. and its allies, especially. Any U.S. president who would continue the effort started in 1990 by President George Herbert Walker Bush to conquer and grab control of the resources of post-communist Russia is insane, especially now after the February 2014 U.S.-run coup in Ukraine crossed the line that Russia had repeatedly warned must not be crossed. If this effort ever stops, the news media won't report the U.S. gang's retreat from this by now 25-year-long war against Russia, which those same news media have consistently refused to report. But even if they were to report it, no obligation by the West is so important as the obligation to stop it. The obligation to call off the West's Saudi, Qatari, Turkish, UAE, Kuwaiti finance, Sunni terrorists, and the rest of the West's, via NATO, the IMF, etc., war against Russia and against Russia's Shiite and BRICS allies. That comes from the article, How Corruption Cripples America's Military, U.S. versus Russian Weaponry, Who Wins? By Eric Zeus, posted February 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Saturday, February 6th marks Leonard Peltier's 40th year in prison. He's been serving two consecutive life sentences for the first-degree murders of two federal agents during a famous firefight which took place on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Peltier's incarceration is widely perceived as unjust as well as politically motivated, given his alliance with the American Indian Movement at a time when that organization posed a challenge to U.S. federal authorities. One man who's familiar with this case is Ward Churchill. He's written and spoken extensively on not only Peltier, but on the way the Federal Bureau of Investigation has contained popular struggles against colonial power. Ward Churchill served as professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder from 1990 until 2007. His work focuses on the U.S. government's historical treatment of political dissenters and resistors. Ward Churchill has long been affiliated with the American Indian Movement of Colorado and was a resident of the Northern Plains, Colorado region before moving to Atlanta in 2013, where he continues his writing and research. He has authored several books, including 1988's agents of repression, the FBI's secret wars against the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, with Jim Vanderwell from South End Press. 1990s, the COINTELPRO papers, documents from the FBI's secret war against domestic dissent, again with Jim Vanderwell, also from South End Press. And 2003's On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, reflections on the consequences of U.S. imperial arrogance and criminality, from AK Press. I had a chance recently to interview Ward Churchill. During our conversation, we explored the history of U.S. state counterinsurgency warfare, the so-called COINTELPRO program, American Indian Movement involvement in the Pine Ridge Oglala Nation region in what is called South Dakota, and the famous case of Leonard Peltier. Here is that conversation. I wanted to help provide us some historical context, because as I understand it, this has been an evolution of already existing practices within the FBI going back to the early 20th century, which cracked down on groups like the Industrial Workers of the World and the communists.
Well, actually, it goes back even further than the early 20th century. You find the origins of this. I don't want to take it too far, because you can find the actual origins in France and so on, the early part of the 19th century. But it emerges in the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which is the precursor of the FBI. After the so-called Civil War down here, Pinkerton Detective Agency was the entity that was retained by the newly formed Justice Department of the United States to perform investigative work with regard to violation of federal law, ostensibly at least. But quite a lot of that activity, Pinkerton activity, went to enforcing the status quo, moneyed interests and so forth, in a manner consistent with what federal government wanted to see accomplished, that is, do with developing the railroad net in this country, and development of heavy industry and so forth. Went to attacking the labor movement, went to keeping the racial status quo in effect and so forth. And a lot of the techniques that were used with regard to the Molly Maguires in the Pennsylvania coal fields, for example, these were the pioneering techniques of political repression that were perfected in concert with the federal government and various state governments and major corporate interests. Infiltration of agents provocateurs, that is, people who are infiltrated to engage, propose whatever criminal activity that could be used into mount ostensibly non-political criminal charges against particularly select key activists and so forth, political assassination, either de facto or de jure, de facto by extra legal use of the criminal justice system to accomplish neutralization, as it becomes known, of key activists, and sometimes massive repression of rank-and-file membership, but also de jure, which is to say literally using state forces, often in clandestine fashion, to effect outright assassinations of targeted activists. Disinformation campaigns, which come to do with the issuance of black and gray propaganda. Black propaganda often attributed falsely to political activists themselves, gray propaganda having to do with essentially what we would now call spin, to affect a general popular discrediting of political movements, orchestration of false charges in the judicial system, political imprisonment. They've literally had facilities that were designated pretty much continuously since the late part of the 19th century to hold political activists. activists in the sense we ordinarily understand them, but also activists in the sense that the status quo understands them, which has to do with the rank and file union membership, for example. The membership of political organizations and so on could be consigned to special facilities. They constructed camps in Idaho to basically round up United Mine Workers membership or Western Federation of Mine Workers or Miners membership en masse. You had that occur also in Arizona. Now, these are nominally private entities, these detective agencies, and Pinkerton was the most prominent, but you had Burns Detective Agency and a number of others that came into being because there was great demand for the sort of operative service to orchestrate the disruption and to gather intelligence. Pinkerton was right clear about the key to all politically repressive efforts, maintaining order, as they called it, had to do with knowing what was going on and who was in the process of doing it at all times. And so you had this nationwide informant net that was concocted, created. People who were nominally members of activist organizations, people who would provide information based upon political disagreements, competitiveness, petty jealousies. They worked on all of this and still do, because what you're seeing emerge out of the Pinkertons, which is that entity was replaced as the investigative agency, as you say, in the early part of the 20th century by what was initially simply called the Bureau of Investigation. It doesn't become the Federal Bureau of Investigation until the 1930s.
But, now, just in terms of these...
Those techniques form the template for what becomes COINTELPRO ultimately. But you have the repression of the labor movement, particularly immigrants, in the early part of the 20th century. The anarchist movement was especially targeted, and the IWW stuff ties to that with the so-called Palmer raids, nationwide raids on immigrant labor halls and so forth that occurred in 1919, 1920, nationwide mass deportations and mass incarcerations and the targeting of the Communist Party and the Communist Workers' Party, or Communist Labor Party, excuse me, came right out of that in the 1920s. Supposedly, there's a period after the Palmer raids because they were so visible at the time, so draconian in their approach that the liberal establishment was appalled and they put an end to it. And J. Edgar Hoover, the famous FBI director for life, was installed on the basis of a promise that FBI would be, or the Bureau of Investigation, as it was known at the time, would no longer engage in political surveillance and repression activities, but never stopped. It never stopped.
That whole
continued through the 1920s and really took off again in the 1930s.
So when we come to the era in the 1960s and the emergence of COINTELPRO, in what ways was that distinct from the previous efforts? Was it merely a refinement of previous methods?
Or? Yeah, it's a centralization and rendering it more systematic. COINTELPRO, you know, that's an acronym, or more properly, you might put it as a cryptonym, because it was a secret program during its formal duration. Simply means counterintelligence program. Now, what's different about this innocuous-sounding counterintelligence program captioned COINTELPRO is that it is specifically focused on domestic dissidents. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're targeting agents of foreign powers, the standard constitutional protections and so forth do not apply, all right? That's as a matter of law. You can do things to neutralize a Soviet spy or a German spy earlier on, and so forth, that you cannot do to a U.S. citizen. the point of a counterintelligence operation is, and I'm paraphrasing an FBI official explaining it, is to neutralize the target by whatever means. You can do that by killing them. You can do that by exposing them. You can do that by discrediting them. You can do that by what's called badjacking them, convincing their intelligence agency that they become double agents, and they may be liquidated then by their own organization, and so on and so on and so on. Now, none of these are legal in the context of constitutional protections in the United States, but given essentially war, in the context of war, these are enemy agents that are not U.S. citizens.
So neutralizing
all these techniques, they created a rationalization. This is what the secret program to systematically utilize these techniques, these counterintelligence techniques against U.S. dissidents, U.S. citizens. It's not counterintelligence, it's counter subversion. And at a certain point, in their own documents, it becomes counterinsurgency because they're referring to targets, particularly in the American Indian movement, not in terms of being radicals or political extremists, but in terms of being insurgents. Well, if you're going after insurgents, combat insurgents, it's by definition counterinsurgency. This is a technique of war. So war was mounted against American Indian movement, but arguably, although that particular vernacular was not employed against the Black Panther Party and other political organizations in the late 1960s, early 1970s, on, I would argue, right on through to today.
Mm. So you were just mentioning the Black Panther Party, and that seemed to be one of the most dynamic threats to the establishment. And so I guess I don't know if you want to say some words about how that the success that the COINTELPRO program had in undermining that efforts. I mean, if there's just maybe a couple of a couple of the main features of that crackdown that appears to have done them in.
Well, it's not a crackdown, okay? They're not cracking down on criminal activity. They're criminalizing. They're misrepresenting, often using their own operatives that have been infiltrated in the organization to make statements that they could record, then print in the press in order to misrepresent the positions and policies of the organization targeted, in this case, the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party was actually a lawful organization. You see, the problem was it was a black organization, and so when they availed themselves of this revered Second Amendment right of American citizens to bear arms in public, okay, and to defend themselves against unwarranted aggression and all the rest of that. Well, this is black folk with guns. This is unacceptable. They actually start in California where this begins. They changed the law to delegitimate what had always been perfectly legitimate practice simply because it was black people doing it. And if you look at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, it had a self-determining component to it, obviously, but primarily was based on, hey, equal rights under the law and community self-sufficiency and all these good things that the status quo is always saying it wants black people to do when they were actually doing it.
Yeah, it does seem strange to me.
On that basis, J. Edgar Hoover proclaimed the Black Panther Party to be the number one internal security threat to the United States. That's all 5,000-odd members of the Black Panther Party. Now, the preeminent internal security threat to the United States is an inner-city-based organization of 5,000 members, then there is no particular internal security threat to the United States, except that the message of the Panthers was, you know, if you've got an equitable situation, you change it by taking charge of your own affairs. do for yourself. Organize the community, the resources of the community to meet community needs, and do not be dependent upon those who are oppressing you to fulfill them.
Is that what the real threat of the party was, that they were actually setting up things like, you know, feeding people and education and all of that, rather than the gun aspect that, you know, the NRA should conceivably be in full sympathy with?
Well, they had a problem with the guns because that created a certain parity with the police, at least symbolically. And that won't do, because blacks are to be subjugated, okay? They're to be intimidated, cowed into accepting things that are absolutely unacceptable because the alternatives were even worse. And when you say you got a right to defend yourself, including from a cop who is violating your rights, which is, there's all kinds of judicial precedent on that in the United States. You know, that changes the calculus. It changed the calculus of police violence directed against the black community in Oakland dramatically in a single year. The Panther Street Patrols, well, that's the antithesis of what those in charge want to see happen. And so, yeah, a whole lot of propaganda was made in the basis of the armed component of the Panther program, but it was a self-defense, and articulated such a self-defense posture, not an aggressive posture, mm-hmm. not an attack of the police. It's defend yourself when the police attack you. You see, big difference. They always talk about the violence-prone Panthers, but it was the Panthers who were getting shot, so I don't know what their violence propensity was. What, attacking police bullets with their chests? Mm-hmm. You got 30-odd dead Panthers pretty much before you ever see,
of course,
any casualties on the other side. So even when it becomes firefights, straight up firefights between the Panthers and the police, the Panthers are defending themselves against attack. But yes, in answer to your earlier question, the Breakfast for Children program that you mentioned in particular was named number one priority for destruction by Hoover himself. The idea that the blacks could organize in a manner which would render their oppressed communities self-sufficient was absolutely to be halted, because they wouldn't then not be in this subjugated posture. And what that is a defense of the key word, order. You know, there's that old cliche about, it comes out of the anal compulsion of German households for orderliness. There's a place for everything, and everything's in its place. Well, this is the social corollary. There's a place for everyone, and everyone is to remain in their place. And you can see the place assigned to black folk. You can see the place assigned for the Mexican population north of the Rio Bravo. You can see the place to which Asian immigrants were assigned, and you can certainly see the place to which American Indians were assigned in the racial hierarchy, the structure of white supremacism in the United States then and now.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Pine Ridge Reservation is located in what is known as South Dakota at the border with Nebraska. U.S. surveyors had strategic interest in the territory owing to the rich uranium and molybdenum deposits situated there. However, in order to gain control of those deposits, the federal government would be legally required to forge a deal with the reservation's tribal government. The Lakota people were by and large hostile to any deals that would see more of their territory yielded to the feds. As a result, U.S. federal authorities arranged to have a local stooge named Dickie Wilson take charge. Ward Churchill described Wilson as a plumber and bootlegger. With the resources he received from outside, Wilson was able to secure a powerful base in the community. However, the nepotism and other corrupt practices he allegedly embraced proved too much for other community members to endure, so an opposition formed, calling itself the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization, or OSCRO, and orchestrated an impeachment process. Wilson was able to defend himself by financing a kind of paramilitary called the Guardians of Oglala Nation, or Goons, which reported directly to him and was set up to intimidate the opposition. Or Churchill explained what happened next and how Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement got involved in the community.
At that point, they began to fund Wilson with basically highway funds to establish what was initially called the Tribal Rangers Group, becomes known as the Goon Squads, quite appropriately. Wilson's Goons, which is a paramilitary force, and they were trying to intimidate the OSCRO people. They were getting serious resistance to that. You had a spike in violence occurring on Pine Ridge. They sent in this 60-man special operations group of federal marshals, as they called it, in baby blue jumpsuits to set up machine gun positions and right on top of the tribal building sandbag positions. And you had these guys patrolling with basically military hardware to maintain order during the impeachment. Okay. In effect, Wilson was then named to preside over his own impeachment hearing, and he sent out tribal police, which was heavily overlapped with this goon squad that we're talking about. Two-thirds of the tribal police are known members of the goon squad by the time this is done. Arrested the tribal council members who were opposed to him, so that only his own guys were sitting at the impeachment hearing over that he has his own basically named the chair himself and then told the chair what to say, and began the impeachment by running a short film put out by the John Birch Society called Anarchy USA, basically saying his oppositions wanted to instill anarchy as a condition of life on the reservation, and it was his explanation of why he had to be retained. And then, you know, everybody voted. Everybody that was not in a jail cell, which were all of his own appointees or his surrogates, basically. And so I think there were four people voted. That's all of the tribal council that was actually there, but whatever it was, the report was he was unanimously continued in office. And he immediately then came out and issued a ban, a public statement, issued a ban on meetings, political meetings on Pine Ridge Reservation. Well, that's when the old people called for American Indian Movement to come to Pine Ridge. In effect, American Indian Movement and the Oglala Resistance went to Wounded Knee to convene a glorified press conference and were immediately surrounded by Wilson's goons. And shortly after the goons had established their roadblocks, the marshals were setting up roadblocks in conjunction with that, and then the FBI showed up, and then the Army advisors were sent from the White House, and there you have it. So you have this 71-day siege that's always called the Occupation of Wounded Knee. Well, they didn't go there to occupy the place, you know, other than temporarily, as I say, for purposes of attracting media attention, getting the message out of what was happening on Pine Ridge. But they certainly got media attention on the basis of this 71-day siege when you've got armored personnel carriers provided by to the federal authorities by the South Dakota National Guard, and you've got machine guns on full display, and you've got 500,000 rounds of gunfire exchanged, and you've got one marshal, one FBI guy hit, two Indians killed, about 20 people seriously wounded. So you got a lot of media play, a lot of public attention.
Interesting.
But then you've also got a specialist in political repression, a guy by the name of Richard G. Held. Richard Held is instrumental in setting up the counterinsurgency operation that occurs in Pine Ridge in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. This is basically the method that was being used by the CIA in Latin America at the time, that they would enlist the local police forces and components of the military and so forth, forming death squads, and that's exactly what they were called in Latin America. Those who were the strong traditionals were requesting, in many cases, and this is true with regard to the Peltier case at the Jumping Bull property outside Oglala, they had requested, they'd been harassed by the goons, they felt threatened. These are old people, Harry and Cecilia, Jumping Bull. They requested the security be provided by American Indian Movement in the Northwest AIM group, which is Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler in particular, but it's a somewhat larger group than that. Mm-hmm. Provided they set up a camp down by Cottonwood Creek to secure the property and to protect these old people and the younger members of the family as well from goon violence. And so that was taken as a target. The FBI basically had made the decision that we will break the back of the American Indian Movement and the Oglala Resistance right here, right now. You know, we thought they would have given up long before this, but they haven't. So we need to really have a major incident that can justify the introduction of overwhelming force. Well, they got that with the Oglala firefight. They got two dead agents.
Essentially a public relations exercise. Yeah.
Two dead FBI agents, that makes headlines. And they hyped it beyond belief that it was, they were lured into an ambush. Well, there was no ambush. And they were fired on with automatic weapons from fixed positions once they'd been lured into the kill zone. There were no fixed positions, and there were no automatic weapons. You even had a report come out of there within about 24 hours that the agents had been scalped. None of which was true, and the FBI knew it because immediately after the firefight, they had control of the ground. Okay? They had the bodies. They knew there were no fixed positions. There was no indication, and they knew that because the firefight went on for a considerable period of time. They were taking no automatic weapons fire, and on and on and on. When Tom Cole was the FBI spokesman who convened the press conference, put out the disinformation to make the headlines to justify what they were going to do next, he flat lied about all of it, and he knew that he was lying. Okay? He knew you could make... If you want to be an apologist for the FBI, you can say that FBI Director Clarence Kelly, when he repeated the same stuff in L.A. a day after that, he may not have known the details because he was not there, but Tom Cole and the agents who were on the scene definitely did know. Okay, so disinformation was put out about that.
Mm-hmm. And
there was an Indian man killed that day, too, by the name of Joe Stuntz. Unmentioned, they put together what they call RESMERS investigation, reservation murders. Well, they weren't investigating all these murders that we've been talking about. They're investigating only the deaths of the two agents, and not even Joe Stuntz, who was killed at the same time. Yeah, and what they wanted to do was target people who were clearly committed AIM members and from off the reservation if they could. There were a lot of locals who were in a Jumping Bull, a contained camp, were on the Jumping Bull property that day, who were involved in the firefight. This was known to the FBI, too. They targeted for charges only members of the Northwest AIM group. So they're trying to divide the locals from the non-locals, divide the Indians, even the resistant Indians, against one another.
Yeah.
The us versus them. So you're getting local people who they don't know what to do in the condition. They want to protect their local boys. And so, well, you got these dead agents, and that clearly happened in 250-odd militarily equipped FBI agents pouring onto that reservation within 48 hours they were in place. You know, the overwhelming force aspect is in effect. So the locals, when queried often, are saying, well, it was those outside guys who did it, and they're trying to protect the, you know, basically their nieces, nephews, sons, daughters, whatever. So it was a very effective tactic.
Leonard Peltier had fled to Canada shortly after the incident. He was arrested and extradited to the U.S. based on fabricated evidence, including an affidavit from what he described as a psychologically compromised woman named Myrtle Poorbear. As she herself would later attest, Myrtle was made to fabricate a story about how she was Leonard's girlfriend and that she had heard him talk about how he had orchestrated to murder the two agents. While these proceedings were taking place, two other AIM members were also implicated in the deaths of the two FBI agents and were being tried for the crime in Peltier's absence.
Meanwhile, they had captured Butler and Robidoux separately, one in Kansas, one in South Dakota. And they had two of the three, so they went to trial in Cedar Rapids. Okay, and the charges against them are the same charges against Leonard Peltier. They're, in effect, his co-defendants. But they're being prosecuted first because they're available for prosecution, and the feds want to get some motion on this while Peltier's still sitting in Ocala, and you got this indefinite period before he's going to be coming back. Okay? Now, they presented the argument about this being a conspiracy and to lure the agents into the trial, all the rest of it. But you had a judge there that allowed considerable latitude in the development of a self-defense argument. Nobody said. Bob and Dino, neither of them said that they did not participate. In fact, Bob, to all intents and purposes, said, I killed them both. Okay? Mm-hmm. Both were mortally wounded by large bore, 44 caliber, in fact. That's a pretty big weapon. He said, I was the only one using a 44 Magnum during a firefight. Another guy had it. He was a lousy shot, and I'm not, so I took it away from him, and I used that. Bob said, I did. I was the one, in effect, who killed him, and I would do it again because of the way the FBI was comporting itself. And you had the defense called people from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission who had investigated what was happening on Pine Ridge, and the FBI director himself. All upshot was the jury determined that under the conditions that had been created by the FBI, it was the only reasonable course of action to defend themselves against the attack. And they were acquitted on the basis of having acted in self-defense reasonably. So this leaves Leonard Peltier as the only possible conviction. And if you look at Peltier's case, once they got him back down here, that whole conspiracy notion had gone away. And he was prosecuted on the basis of being lone gunman.
Yeah.
Well, I would submit to you that it's at least plausible. I don't believe it's true in either instance, but it's at least plausible that the federal prosecutors believed that there was a conspiracy. Or they believed there was a lone gunman. But they presented both cases, and they couldn't possibly have believed both.
Mm.
So you had this knowing tailoring of the facts in one or both cases. I would argue in both cases. And they were not successful the first time, and they really went about tailoring things. They went judge shopping, and they had the entire trial record from Cedar Rapids declared inadmissible as evidence in court again during the trial against Peltier, so that agents, for example, J. Gary Adams, who was present at the on site at the time, he was the first agent that tried to go in after the firefight had begun, and he took fire and retreated and hid in a ditch until it was all over. And felt guilty about it, apparently, because these were his two friends that were getting killed while he hid in a ditch. Okay, he testified to one set of facts at Cedar Rapids in a completely different set of facts of what he had observed against Peltier, and the defense was disallowed by the judge from impeaching his testimony based upon his prior testimony. You see how this worked. Completely different case, the same set of facts presented against Peltier would have been unsuccessful in Cedar Rapids against Butler and Robidoux. So that was a railroad job from start to finish. Yeah. And you've had jurors have said since, if we had been aware of this at the time, we would have voted the opposite. You see, so they had a very cooperative judge, you could say, Paul Benson, that resulted in Peltier's conviction.
And yet, and, we've seen over the years
the evidence that was presented, the physical evidence is absurd, and even the Eighth Circuit Court has arrived at that conclusion. Mm. And I can't remember, and the last appeal that went to the Eighth Circuit Court, the three-judge panel, this is in the mid-'80s, 1985, I believe, three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court that heard Peltier's appeal, headed by William Webster, who wasn't even there to issue the opinion because he'd already become appointed director of the FBI. So he handled the appeal, despite knowing he now had this inherent conflict of interest, big-time conflict of interest. You know, Judge Haney, who read out the opinions that, you know, the record demonstrates significant misconduct on the part of the FBI. But to remand this for a retrial would impute even further misconduct, and this we're reluctant to do. Which is the same as saying if this was any ordinary case, this would have, the verdict would have been thrown out right then and there on the basis of what was known about the manipulation of evidence and so forth, shell casings and such. You know, they would have gone back to trial and probably you'd have had a different outcome.
There have been multiple appeals, though.
In this case, he stays in prison rather than tarnish the reputation of the FBI.
So, yeah. So, I mean, does this... The fact that the FBI, I mean, the FBI, it's in their own interests. I mean, regardless of considerations of justice, it's in their interests to keep Leonard Peltier behind bars until he dies, essentially.
Oh, very much in their interest, but it's a broader interest that's served by that, too. And in a way, their interest is served by it being known that he was flat-out railroaded, falsely convicted, that they orchestrated this as a consequence for basically standing on his rights and not equivocating. And the message is, if you do that, if you make yourself aware of your rights and you refuse to relinquish them when you're instructed to do so, there are consequences. Mm. Here's the consequences. Okay? If you don't want to end up like Leonard Peltier, do what you're told.
Mm. Now,
and the more it's obvious that he is framed, railroaded into this position and sitting in a cage as a result of his political attitude, you know, the better it is from their point of view in conveying that message. And the only way to counter that message, of course, would be to get him out. Well, actually, rephrase that, it would have been, haven't been able to get him out earlier. Say in the mid-1980s when the court determined that it was a bogus case, but left him in prison anyway.
So, would you say
that... The Supreme Court, incidentally, refused twice on two separate appeals. Found reversible error 13 times in the initial appeal, but failed to reverse. U.S. Supreme Court declined to review the matter and let that stand. And then you have this, where the court itself is saying the FBI, the record is fraught with FBI misconduct. And we have, it was a Bagley decision. We had two different standards for reversing cases in two different appellate courts. that's exactly the sort of thing Supreme Court is supposed to resolve when you've got conflicting standards between federal districts. Mm-hmm. They declined that one, too. So.
Yes, and as well, President Clinton went back on a promise to have him released, presumably.
Well, Clinton went back on a promise to have him released. Clinton's Clinton.
Yeah.
you know, he's purely an opportunist, but he was basically informed by the FBI, you can do this. We can't stop you. Okay, but if you do, you'll be under FBI investigation on stuff like Whitewater and so on for the rest of your life. Or you can not do it, and we'll just basically leave you alone.
We've seen kind of a whispers of resistance in the form of Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, and I'm wondering what lessons can be learned that might feed into a vibrant resistance. How can we avoid what's happened to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement moving forward?
Well, consciousness is the first thing, and I've been working on that all my adult life. I mean, I was personal friends with Mark Clark, who was one of the, I mentioned it earlier, the Hampton Clark assassinations in Chicago in 69. So I've been working on this with a personal interest of that sort ever since. Being aware of it and how it works and why it works that way is the first thing. Know your enemy, I suppose. Have an actual understanding of the structural realities we're up against. So rather than just having this gut reaction to this isn't fair, this isn't right, this is wrong, we need to change it, have some real concrete understanding of what it is you're trying to change and consequently how it would need to be changed, where you're going, and so on. Okay. You mentioned two recent phenomena, one of which I find very encouraging, the other of which not so much. And then the not so much end was Occupy, because deliberately vacuous nature of analysis. Not that they're wrong about the 1%, although I would extend it a little further than 1%. Framing it 1 versus 99 as a good rhetorical flourish in an initial level, but you can't seriously argue, if you're going to do organizing in more oppressed communities, that they're in the same boat as some guy who's only making about $1.5 million a year, okay, because he's not a member of the 1%. He's part of the 99%. And they actually had this really stupid, in my view, sort of rule in this rule-free organization that you really couldn't highlight the conditions in any given community versus any other, because that would be divisive. Well, that actually was divisive. That vacuous sort of premise that you can't talk about specific Indian issues of the sort that we've been talking about, because that would divide them away from the settler population that might feel bad. It was kind of, maybe, in a superficial sort of way, heartening to see large numbers of people coming out in opposition. But it was going to go nowhere, and it was going to go nowhere based upon what I was saying. That's my take on that. Black Lives Matter is much more promising, but they got to get beyond, well, several things, and we'll say they might, but one, in the context of what we're talking about today, you know, blacks are actually not the most frequently, young black men actually, or not the most frequently, killed by police. American Indians are. Blacks tend to get killed by cops with dash cameras and stuff in urban areas where there's more of a possibility there's going to be media exposure on it. Indians tend to get killed more often in rural areas by somebody whose department doesn't really concern itself with things like dash cams and so forth because there's no pressure. And so it goes. But proportionately, the rate is higher for Indians than it is for blacks. And I'm not making an argument as to who's the most oppressed. Well, I am making an argument that's worth consideration, that it ought to at least be mentioned and taken into the calculus. But we always talk about, quote, minorities mm-hmm. as being black and brown, and sometimes they include Asians. Indians aren't even on the list.
Yeah.
I may be a little different in Canada, depending on what part of Canada you're in particularly. But that's the reality down here. And that consciousness has to change for the movement to be successful. Otherwise, you get so-called liberation of various oppressed communities, all predicated upon ongoing colonization and oppression of American Indians. And that's just colonialism continued. Change forms someone. Well, and I'm not especially interested in talking about a better or worse form of colonialism. As far as I'm concerned, colonialism and oppression are colonialism and oppression, and it doesn't really matter who's administering that.
Okay. Well, Ward Churchill, I've really appreciated this conversation. I know we've touched on some very important realities facing the people of all different persuasions, all different colors, and I want to thank you for sharing those insights with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's my pleasure.
Okay.
Or not, but it was my privilege, I suppose.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Take care.
On January 10th, an MRI confirmed that Leonard Peltier suffered from abdominal aortic aneurysm, placing his life in jeopardy. The International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is urging supporters to contact the Federal Bureau of Prisons to demand timely treatment for Peltier as well as a transfer to a suitable medical facility. The ILPDC is also renewing the call for presidential clemency by President Barack Obama so that Peltier can spend the rest of his remaining years as a free man. For details, visit www.whoisleonardpeltier.info. That concludes this week's edition of the Global Research News Hour. Next week will be a special fundraiser for the Global Research News Hour's host radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. The fundraiser will be a live broadcast starting Friday, February 12th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, which can be streamed at ckuw.ca. Regular listeners are encouraged to donate to our station by visiting www.ckuw.ca/donate and pledging at any level. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to our partners across Canada and the United States, as well as to the website globalresearch.ca and the Progressive Radio Network, which podcast our shows. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Thanks again for joining us.